I'm Barb DeMarco Barrett, and you're listening to Writers on Writing. We're doing something different today. We're having a panel of writers and an editor. The anthology, Coolest American Stories 2022, edited by Mark Wish and Elizabeth Coffey, was released in January, and I'm pleased to have with me Mark Wish and two fellow writers from the book, Mary Toller and David Ebenbach. We talked about writing and publishing short fiction, finding your voice, and how Mark Wish and Elizabeth Coffey chose stories and arranged those stories in the anthology, and so much more. I had a lot of fun with this one, so I hope you enjoy it as much as we all did. So, Mark, I am so curious about the idea for the anthology. If you can remember the seeds of Coolest American Stories 2022 and when you knew you had to do it.
That's very easy to remember. The day after January 6th, the day after the resurrection, Elizabeth and I were taking one of our early morning walks, and we would take them even earlier than, even though it was cold in, you know, January, because of COVID, because we were trying to avoid people. And we usually then took our walks in Riverside Park. So we were out there, it was icy, it was cold. We had our masks on. We were, afraid of people with masks. Most people wore masks because we were on the Upper West Side, but some weren't. And the ones that aren't, or in New York City, by the way, are super aggressive. So it was, you know, we were somewhat, it was just that it was that time. We all know what that's like. But add in the day after the insurrection, and it's still kind of dark out, early morning, very cold, very icy. You know, you're watching out for watching your step. And I was troubled by the insurrection big time. And Elizabeth was also, but she does not, sometimes she prefers not to talk about these things. And I just kind of was talking about it. And I don't know, popped in my head. What can we, you know, freaking do about this as writers and publishing people? And I don't know. I just said, wouldn't it be nice if there could be an anthology of short stories that a lot of people could like, you know, in America? And I was thinking patriotically, as it were, you know, in the old, you know, way of thinking of patriot, not in the, you know, Trump person way of thinking patriotically. And so Elizabeth wasn't quite sure what I was talking about. And I said, well, you know, people would write these stories just for the sake of storytelling. Like you tell a good story when you're at a party or at a, you know, at a bar or something. And, you know, everyone's just sort of relaxed and they're just kind of hanging out. And people would then read them for the same reason. And somehow in my mind, it was definitely wishful thinking. I thought, that would be a nice thing to try to make happen. And I don't know, Elizabeth was like, yeah, let's do it. And that surprised me. And we both realized how kind of silly it was, really, in a way. But we just became intent on it. And that's how it started.
I'm trying to remember how I learned of the anthology. And, a friend was rejected from it. And she said, you should try this one. I think it's going to be good. My story wasn't right, but yours might be. And I am curious, well, a couple of things with Mary and David, how you both found out about it. And Mark, how did you get the word out?
Barbara, by the way, that was my first question that I jotted down, was to ask all of you guys how you heard about it, because I'm curious about that. So I'm interested to hear what Mary and David say.
Yeah, Mary.
This is Mary. I found out about it from a friend who's, I think she knows you, Mark, and she suggested I submit. I think, were you able to submit more than one story? Because I ended up submitting two, and
yes,
fairly soon I heard from you and a yes, and I was thrilled.
Can we? Yeah, we can mention that friend's name. Now it's coming back to me. Lori Austin.
Lori Austin. Yes.
Was that how we pronounce it? Oslin?
Oslin. She's a Flannery O'Connor short story winner, and she has a novel.
And will be the Flannery O'Connor Award
judge this year.
Person who runs the whole thing. Yeah.
Right. Right. This year, coming up.
She knows the short story.
Yeah. You know, a Flannery O'Connor award winner told me too, Colette Sartor. Yeah, Colette Sartor. Oh,
yes, Facebook friend. Tell Colette to submit again. I don't know why she didn't submit again.
I don't either.
I think Facebook is where I heard about it, actually. Is that, does that ring true? I don't remember for sure, but I feel like I saw maybe in the calls for submissions group. I spend a little too much time on Facebook, and I think I might have spotted it there. And then I had a similar experience to Mary. I sent a story in, and I wasn't even sure that it was cool, but you said it was, so...
Well, I remember that, David, and I think it was fairly early on.
It was.
And I was blown away. I remember between the 7th and we didn't actually put up our website and make our call for submissions until the day after the inauguration, because we were so afraid there was going to be another attack. I think that was January 23rd or 22nd, if I'm not mistaken. And we thought there might be another attack, and we're like, well, we can't have our thing coming out saying, oh, Americans is all going to get together again because of these cool stories when there's a second huger attack, right? So we had to wait. So the my point is that I think it was about the 23rd. And David, if I'm not mistaken, it was maybe only about a week later. And we had received, you know, maybe only about, you know, not that many. We'd hoped it would have been a lot, but we were just slowly getting the word out. And yours came, and I... You know, from the start, from sentence one, and I think Barbara, you and Mary, you know what I'm talking about, and well, any other readers who've read David's story, all of this is water. You know, from sentence one on, totally taken, David, just absolutely, and you know, yes, what is cool? I don't know. I don't really know who's to say what is cool, but it felt cool to me, and it felt cool to Elizabeth. I mean, we sort of had tears in our eyes, and. We did have tears in her eyes, and you know, she just looked at me and said, "That's a coolest story right there." That sort of defined it, because if I'm not mistaken, that was the first one we took.
You told me it was the first one. I actually would love to hear you say thank you for all that. I'd love to hear you say what you think cool means, because when I think about Mary's story or Barbara's story, that I like for sure. I think cool. You know, there's this real sort of got to find out what's going to happen factor. They're really surprising and fascinating and fresh, and the stakes are really high. So they sort of strike me immediately as cool, but I'd love to know what you think that you mean.
What we meant then, and you know, it's evolved a little bit over, it's been more, a little more than a year now. What we meant then was, we tried to distill down that long thing I just gave about what we thought about on that morning to, well, what could bring people together? And the main word we came up with three words: interesting, engaging, and appealing to people from all walks of life. And then we said, well, what if we have to choose one word of those three? And we decided that was interesting. And I guess you could say, well, interesting to whom? And again, then I guess you would throw on to people from all walks of life. And I remember thinking that when I read that story, I thought, you know, people can say this is literary, and, you know, people can say, oh my God, there's stuff in here about mental illness. We need a trigger warning. And people in some areas of the country or from some backgrounds can say, oh my God, there's this homosexuality referred to in here. And it's urban, and it's Washington, D.C., and I hate Washington, you know, but it didn't matter. It was this sibling brotherly love, and it was so, you know, family love exuded from it so much, just out of every word, that I thought, you know, to me is like, how is that not interesting to everyone? Everyone has had a sibling, and if they haven't, they've wanted one, I think. Mm-hmm. And it captured, I mean, I've had some difficulties with siblings myself, and so it struck me a little more, but when, you know, Elizabeth gets along with her two sisters pretty much fine, and when she read it, she just kind of went to pieces also. So we knew,
David, do you have the story right there? Can you read from it, David?
I do have I have the book.
If you and Mary both, and I will too, read the first page or the first couple of paragraphs,
that would be great.
Let's say the title again. All of This is Water by David Ebenbach.
I guess it makes a creepy kind of sense that I was in a traffic jam, an inexplicable Sunday traffic jam, when I got the news. My little car was surrounded by SUVs and minivans, me sitting there on Massachusetts Avenue, squeezing the steering wheel and worrying about being late to pick my brother up at Union Station, and thinking, why does something like this always have to happen? When it came over the radio in soft tones. 2 days earlier, September 12th, 2008, the writer David Foster Wallace, suicide. It hit me like a smack in the head. I snapped my eyes to the radio on the dashboard, like I was going to see an explanation there, or maybe somehow my brother's face reacting to the news. And though I was only looking down for a moment, it was long enough that I missed the chance to tap my brakes in time. I bumped the Jeep in front of me. Not hard, but definitely a bump. And the guy in a banker's button-down Oxford shirt on a Sunday morning got out of the Jeep fast. He was surrounded by traffic, but he ignored it, came around to the back. More cautiously, I got out too, into the heat, the press of metal.
Thank you. Mary, you want to read from yours?
That's me applauding, David, again.
Yeah.
Love sure, that. My story is called 5th of July.
So
they allow Tessa to search the playground for her son Blair's lost identification tag, but she finds only cartridge shells and a prescription bottle packed with weed. She pockets the weed, then picks up Blair and Riley from after school care and heads to the Division of School Safety to get Blair new tags, stamped like the lost ones with his name, emergency contact, religion, and blood type. A line snakes along the perimeter of the low-slung brick government apartment building, and she assesses the hidden dangers. The teenagers with bulky backpacks, the parents with oversized briefcases, the gaunt man with a long, shrouded object jutting over his shoulder. Dread innervates her like a low-grade fever, prickling her skin, drying up the inside of her mouth. The line moves slowly. Tessa has to remind Blair and Riley to keep sheltered between her and the building. Their protection, their survival are always on her mind. She finds little reassurance in the fact that their school was recently rebuilt with serpentine hallways to reduce a shooter's range and classrooms that lock on demand. No school or office or factory, no street corner or park or beach, and certainly not this exposed line of people is truly secure. Gunfire is as omnipresent as guns.
Thank you.
Oh, good.
So much.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah,
let me just say a quick thing about that I didn't realize all the times I've read that story. Never has the sentence, the line, what is the line? The sentence, the line moves slowly, I believe. Never has that sentence been so tense and suspenseful as in that is right there in that beginning of that story.
Thank you.
And there's something so prophetic about that line, gunfire is omnipresent as guns, because we already have too many right now, but there's such a warning there and in the story as a whole about, and what if there were more guns?
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's just such a wise story, I think.
Yeah, it sure is.
Barbara, what about yours?
Yes. Yeah. I will read from Blue Martini. I wanted to be alone. I wanted to be far away. Because every night and every day, Gunther and I fought about stupid things. He always had to have the last word. So did I. Not a good combination. A couple like us couldn't last. The fight we had most often was over the bills. Since he paid all the bills, he'd say, I needed him to help him with his new business. Like hell, I'd say. I wasn't going to get involved with Crystal, no matter what. It rots your brain, I'd tell him. It makes you dull inside. He didn't like that. And the last time I said it, he squeezed my arm so hard, he polka-dotted my skin red and made me yelp. After that, we kept our distance more than usual, which was fine with me. He'd stay out in the RV creating his Breaking Bad concoction, as he liked to call it. If Walter White could get rich manufacturing crystal meth, he'd say to no end, so could he. You idiot, I finally said, it's a TV show. And this set off some major league arguing. Gunther had a degree in chemistry, and like Walter, he thought he might use his education to make real money. He deserved to have a good life, he'd claim more than once. You call this good? I wanted to shout this time. But now, as our voices were rising again, I tried to fight fair by merely saying Walter White was a fictional anti-hero. So as I was reading that, I was thinking about your editing, Mark, because you really helped make this story better. And I think I handed you something like 4,000 words and you wanted a couple thousand more, which I thought was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm.
Is interesting. I submit to a lot of journals and a lot of them have 5,000 word limits and they prefer short stories. And I can never get under 5,000 words.
Right. Yes. Well, you know, that was the same back in the day when I was writing and submitting a lot of short stories. Mine tended to run long. And then the odd thing is also, if you go to, you know, you take your literature course or you go to your, well, I don't know what they're reading now on Reading Lists and MFA programs, but back when I was at UMass Amherst and UC Davis, you'd read these published stories and they were long. I mean, they were many more than 5,000 words. But the thing is, we kind of took a chance, Elizabeth and I, and said, you know, there's a lot of flash out there right now, mm-hmm. and it's all out there online and it's all for free. And don't, you know, maybe in another interview or something, I'll talk all about my theory about how online free flash fiction that the writers must pay $3 a pop to have published. So the publishers who don't have to pay printing costs because they do it online are already ahead even before one reader is satisfied by any story. Well, there's the theory right there. I could go on at length about that. Elizabeth's heard this speech like I don't know how many times. But the point is, we thought, you know, there's a lot of that, and that's good and fine. Everyone's getting a lot of credits. People are excited. People on Twitter are getting all these acceptances. People, if it's really the day of the tweet, then the argument is, yes, a flash or a short short, as we used to call them, is perfect also because it's not that long. We're all so busy. But we just thought, well, what about that old-fashioned story? What about that, you know, not even old-fashioned, just like we came to call it a full meal story, beginning, middle, end, you know, chronological order, not reliant on the language, not just one scene with I don't know, that kind of is edgy or whatever, just storytelling. And again, a little more like that long story that somebody once told you when you were sitting in a bar or at a party and everyone was listening, you know, and the person just went on and on and the story had all these twists and turns. We thought nobody's really, or if somebody's doing that right now, we didn't know where it was. And I've been reading for Pushguard as a contributing editor for God knows how many years. And every year the stories got shorter and shorter and shorter with less plot to them, and to the point where, I mean, and this might have been the precursor for that day when I said let's start this anthology. The last batch that I sent in to Bill Henderson for Pushcart, I was kind of like, really, you're nominating these six stories? I mean, they were good. They were definitely better than all the other ones I saw that year. But if I compared those to the ones I had sent in, say, 10 years earlier, they were not as full fledged. Mm-hmm. And I was reading a lot of them. I mean, I read a lot of short stories online and in literary magazines, et cetera. And so we just thought that we needed more of that. And yes, so that's why I don't even know what it says on the website about our word min or max, but as the year went on, we realized we want longer stories, or just full ones. If somebody could figure out a way to do it in under mm-hmm. 20 manuscript pages, fine. But most of the time they couldn't. So Barbara, I think to get back to your question, as I recall, your story was pretty much intact and I was very excited about it. You know, what did you say? It was maybe about 15 manuscript pages. Maybe that's what it was.
Probably.
And I loved it. And everything was set up so well. I mean, we just heard that opening. You know, you have mm-hmm. the situation. You're definitely on this woman's side. You want to know what's going to happen. You're turning the pages. And I'm not even positive. We don't want to spoil anything for anyone who hasn't read the story. But, well, you know what I'm talking about, Barbara. I was like, what about the aftermath of this situation? I think there still could be. You're so good at suspense. You have mm-hmm. this noir voice that's just, you just click along. My God, you have the reader in your palm. I'm like, no, don't stop. Keep going, you know? And we kind of wanted to see how everything was going to play out vis-a-vis that very great beginning. you know, i.e. with respect to the relationship between her and what was his name again? I'm sorry.
Gunther.
Yeah. How could I forget? and I think, and it wasn't that kind of what I said to you is, you know, what do you say? You get a little more of the aftermath of,
when, right.
You know,
that's right.
Of all that. I'll put it that way to keep it vague.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I did have to extend it a bit, but that, you know, that I was really happy for that note. And I know you have had to reject stories and you've received a bit of flack for it too. And I'm curious, what about the stories you didn't accept? I mean, were they beyond you offering advice to make them better, or did writers not want to mess with them and revise, or how was that, you know, as well as I guess the second part of that question is, because you're a novelist and you've published quite a lot in literary journals, I'm curious about your experience as kind of going from a writer working with editors to being an editor working with writers.
Right. To the first question, what about the rejections, which is a fun one. I'd been the fiction editor of the old Cal Quarterly, the UC Davis, Mary, and your stomping ground, sort of, the old UC Davis literary magazine, which that's no longer around, and the fiction editor of New York Stories. So I had done a little bit of this before, but that was not in the, you know, in the on internet submittable years. That was before. That was all paper, you know, manilas would come in, etc. So I knew a little bit about what could happen with people who get upset when they get rejected. But it's different now. For one thing, people can email you back or send you a message back via submittable in 2 minutes if they want, and they do. And, you know, back then, you know, never call an editor, you know, in the 90s or even before, never by any means phone an editor and never complain about a rejection. Write back and say, thank you so much for rejecting me and please look at another thing. That's how I played it, and, right. And everyone I knew. And there were some people who just, you know, we made it a point, Elizabeth and I, because we both did the submissions. I did most of them, but she did quite a few. We made it a point to always say something positive and something positive, at least usually two things positive about the submission as a story. And then the flat out reason we rejected it. We didn't use the word reject. We usually had a phrase like, we're saying no because, and we would just come right out and say it in one sentence if we could. And, you know, and again, to actually get to your second question is a result of me having been a writer and getting so many responses back from, you know, thousands of responses back over the years from literary magazine editors. And these damn lines like, it is not right for us at this mm-hmm. time. You know, I mean, Jesus Christ.
And that's what they,
you
know, still
so think. What if I send it tomorrow or what? Did I, should I send it last month, or you want me to send this again next year? I mean, you know, you can imagine it, we all have those thoughts and mutter those things, right? But those vague, almost then after you've been published for a while and you say you've even been in the magazine before and you know the editor, you've had a back and forth with them, they send you one of those, you're like, really? You know, well, I don't think it's very respectful and it's not very helpful and it's inefficient for everyone. The way we looked at it, let's, you know, from a writer's point of view, I want to know exactly why they said no, flat out, you know, just tell me.
Right.
And if it hurts, it hurts. That's just going to help me in the long run. The second thing from our point of view is I don't want to see the same story with the same quote unquote problem as we view it here at Coolest American Stories. Five times from one author. You know, we only ask for $1.50 for submission fees. That gets like $1.40 of that, I think, gets eaten up by what we have to give to submittable automatically per fee. And then that extra 10 cents does not cover the 300 or whatever we have to pay at the beginning of the year. So we don't make money on the, so we're not in the business of you continuing to send in 20 stories all year long and we get three, you know, five, however, you know, this amount of money just because you keep effing up and we keep saying no. So we want you to send us something we like. So that's why we come right out and say the reason.
So how many submissions did you get? Excuse
me. Well, let me just finish. The thing is that's not, you would think people would appreciate that. And many have said they have appreciated it, but there are some, I think, are used to the more vague response. Mm. And some people just didn't take it right. They couldn't handle the direct, you know, your story, you know, and we tried to say it as diplomatically as we could, but you know, sometimes, you know, especially for us, it's not, we never said it's not interesting. We would say something, it's not as interesting as the stories we've already bought, something like that. Or the plot is not as developed as the stories we've already bought. Or we would refer to our readership and say, we have a wide audience, or we hope to have a appeal to a wide audience of readers from all across America, not just PhDs, not just MFAs, not even necessarily people who went to college, just people who like to read, maybe even some who don't read anymore because they got sick of reading because it was boring. We want to bring those into the fold. I mean, we weren't saying all that, but I mean, we would make it a point of this is our audience, and we don't think our audience grooves on this thing that when you submitted it to your, you know, MFA class full of PhDs or whatever, they all thought, oh, that's so experimental and fun and heady, you know, that's not what we're about. So we would try to explain that as best we could. And some people, especially the ones who were more degreed and had a decent amount of credits, would get pretty snippy with mm-hmm. us.
Mm-hmm. How many did you get? How many submissions did you get for this?
We did. It's hard to say exactly because we got a bunch through Submittable. And then at first there were a lot coming in with people emailing me, which was a problem. We had to really tell people not to do that anymore because we couldn't keep everything straight. I don't know. Not as many as we'd hoped. 2,000 maybe altogether. Wow. That we looked at. Wow. And remember, that Ooh. Also includes me looking around online and
That's seeking a lot. Out
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. We compared to like when I was at New York Stories, we got, well, I don't really know the numbers back then either, but I had hoped to get more. But again, that includes me also asking people for stories, me going online and looking at them. So I would say, I'm saying we considered that many that actually came here, you know, somewhere then I guess you could say between 1,000 and 2,000.
So, how, you know, when you're reading for something like this, I mean, I can't imagine that you would read the entire story, every story, the entire story. Would you just see how long it kept you? And if it lost you after the first paragraph, put it aside? Or would you give it a good read and read most of it? Or how does that go when you're reading?
I would try to read everything at first, at least. And that was before it ramped up. And also bear in mind, at first there was a lot of flash and short starts. So it was easy to read everything, mm-hmm. but it was also easy to see we're not taking this because it's too short. And that almost became a form letter right there. Where we said, the reason we're taking this is too short. Please send us something more than 20 manuscript pages. Mm-hmm. I got flack from that. I got some people on a tirade for that online on Twitter. Oh my God, how horrible this guy is. And I, even though I would sign it M&E or I sometimes just put Elizabeth's initial down, pretend it was her rejecting because I sort of knew the person and I knew what they were about. And I was like, this is one of those people that I got a bad feeling about this. Right. it would happen anyway. Mm. No, to answer your question, I would read them. We always try to read them all the way through. Maybe Elizabeth skimmed them because she's got a full-time job. A little more, you know, faster than I went into skim mode, which at some point when they all started coming, when more started coming in, they were longer. I would start skimming at some point. Usually, you know, if it was like say a 20-page story and I got to 8 or 10, and really there was no plot so far, it was just talking heads, which you know, a lot were, I would then skim kind of till the where I figured the climax should be, the 3/4 point or you know, 80% point, and then read that to the end, and then really focus on the very last paragraph or two, because sometimes people really go to town on that and you can see, oh, that's what they were trying to do.
Yeah. Well,
but I would definitely always read the end and obviously the first couple of pages very close.
Well, I want to talk about the last paragraph and ending the anthology actually, because I reread your story, Mary, the 5th of July, and that ending was so killer. I mean, the ending is so symbolic with the cross and the trickle of blood and the bird. And I'm curious about that story and where the story came from, and then finding the ending, how that ending came to you, and did it just kind of appear, or did you really have to work it? If you could talk a little about your story and the ending, and then I want to talk to Mark about, and, you know, having it be the last story of the anthology.
Sure, sure. I have different ways of getting into the story. Sometimes it's a scene, a photo. Sometimes it's an incident I heard about. Sometimes I'll write a lot of dialogue and then flesh it out. This started years and years ago as diary entrances. It was Tessa writing in her diary about what was going on. And I actually sent the story out years ago with this format, and it wasn't working. So then I wrote it in first person tense, and it still didn't work. And so I thought, well, I need to get some distance. And I changed the perspective to third person close. And that just seemed to click for me. I knew I wanted to write about guns. This was written probably before Las Vegas, but when Las Vegas happened, I really ramped up for me. And then as I said in my bio in the back of the book, my mother-in-law was also killed in a home invasion. And I was trying on a different tack to write about that. And that was just too close for me. So I dropped that story and picked up this story that at that point was just diary entries, and it all came together. The ending, I took a tin house workshop probably 5-6 years ago and did a seminar on endings. And that's my thing in my story. I always want my endings to really land hard. And I just worked on this for a while, and I knew that Tessa was gonna disintegrate mentally, and I wanted the crow scene in there, and it just came together, fortunately.
Yeah, and I
great ending. It's a great ending, Mary.
I should mention that you know, you mentioned the back of the book talking about where the story came from. I love that you wanted that, Mark, wanted that from all of us writers to talk about the story behind the story. You never get that with anthologies. You never know where the stories came from, right?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, speaking of AWP, or anytime I do ever run into another writer whose story I've seen published, or I just know publishes short stories, that's one of the first questions, or one of the questions I want to ask and definitely make sure I ask. And that is, how did you think of that one? You know, what sparked that one, and how did that process go? Because, you know, obviously you want to, if you see a story you admire, and it really gets you like that. I mean, from the writing standpoint, I just want to know as much dirt as I can on how that process happened for someone else, because maybe I could figure out a way to do that a little bit myself, right? Mm-hmm. So I just thought, there must be other writers out there, and then even readers. I'm understanding from some of the Amazon reviews that just readers just like hearing that. I mean, those are like little stories in themselves. It's almost like there's 26 stories in the volume, because you know, you guys did such a great job of telling those story behind the stories. Mm-hmm. But I just figured a lot of writers must want to know that, and you guys did deliver on that.
Yeah,
such I a love nice that. Idea.
David, I wanted to ask you about All of This Is Water, how you found the voice to that. And you're mostly, I think, a novelist and long form writer and poet.
That's such an interesting thing. For so many years, so I got to say, I have like, I think 7 or 8 unpublished novels that I wrote when I was younger, and they were all terrible. And it's good that they're not published. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I was publishing short stories, and I would love to hear from you two as well, you know, why the short story. But for me, for a long time, it felt like that was the only thing I didn't understand novels. I didn't know why you would be going on at that length about something. I didn't know, like, you know, and so I published short story collections first and poetry. And the novel thing is way more recent. Mm. In fact, I even wrote an article for Glimmer Train about how you have to know who you are. And I knew that I was a short story writer, and only a short story writer. And right after that, I started working on a short story that blew up and became my first novel, which shows you that nobody knows anything about who they are. So just interesting to hear you characterize it in that way. The voice for All of This Is Water kind of fell right out of me. It was one of those stories that, I mean, it certainly had plenty of revision, but the beginning of it came out kind of the way it is, almost at the first go. If you look at the story behind the story for mine, you'll see that, I lost my sister-in-law to suicide. And that is a thing I've written about a lot and in a lot of different ways, written about it from the point of view of people who are struggling and are thinking about, continuing their life or not, but also because, the woman I love beyond all else, my wife, lost her sister. I write a lot about what it's like to be connected to a person who, she spent much of her life trying to save, and who made that choice ultimately for suicide. And the main character is not like my wife particularly, but I guess there's somehow something was forming in me for a long time. And it just kind of fell out that way. Well, and I'll tell you one other thing about it. So David Foster Wallace gave this speech at a commencement where he talked about how you need to change your mind and see, basically see the world around you and see what it is you're assuming and not take things for granted. And at one point he says, it may even save you from blowing your brains out. And I didn't read that speech until after he had taken his own life. And it reads really differently.
Yes, it does.
When that's how you encounter it. Someone had given it to me as like a real kind of pick-me-up speech. They're like, why don't you check this out? The effect it had on me was very different. And so it became the inciting incident for this story coming out.
Interesting.
Can I just say, David, as you were reading that first page, for a story about somebody who is so, the narrator, and then, you're the author, and obviously you have plenty of strong mixed emotions about this horrible thing that happened to your wife's sister. For a narrator who's telling us a story about something that is so emotionally difficult for him, that voice is so darn sure-footed. That's the thing that amazes me about it. And somehow that makes the emotion, for me, it made the emotion ring true or touch me more deeply. Maybe because it was like, my God, this guy's so in control of how he chooses his words. Because I could hear him. It was like he was telling it orally. That's how I read it. But I mean? Like when somebody's telling you something, and they're so maybe traumatized, and or it's so important to them that they maybe even speak more distinctly and they choose their words. That's how sure-footed that beginning and really the whole thing sounded.
Thank you. That is so nice. And it makes me think that, thank you. One of the things about when you lose somebody in that way is that there's a real tendency, I think, to reduce, that person's life and your whole experience with them to that one day when they made that decision. But there's so much that comes before that. I'm not going to give away the ending of All of This Is Water, but I'll say one thing, which is that it jumps into the future to sort of talk about how things turn out. But then it jumps right back to this moment where these two brothers are together, one of them struggling, one of them's trying to help, because those moments really count. And so maybe his sure-footedness is about him making an assertion that we need to care about all of it. Need to care about all of it.
Well, and not to give too much away about the very ending, but with the return back to the present, there's sort of a celebration almost going on. Mm-hmm. A sort of happiness, all things considered, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so Yeah, it and maybe that feeds into what you just said, I think.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah.
And by the way, David, that is cool right there. Oh. What you did with the voice, that's cool. If you ask me.
Thank you.
Barbara, well, I want to ask you about the voice of Blue Martini. Yeah. Mary, you already mentioned about how you went from tried all the different ones. I definitely believe you picked the right one because that voice definitely sings in the third person. But Barbara, is that, I mean, it's a noir voice. You know, if one looks at it just quickly, that would be the category they would throw, or I would throw it, put it into. But there's something more human about it, or I can't think of the right word. But it definitely kind of jumps off the page and keeps you turning pages, definitely. So what is that always your short story writing voice? I mean, I know you do a lot of crime noir stuff. Is that generally your, but I mean, it's true to this one character, right? So tell about that voice and how it came about.
Yeah, I wish I knew. I mean, I love a lot of noir. I don't love all of it, but I don't know, when I started writing, I think the first noir short story I wrote was for Orange County Noir that Akashic published a bunch of years ago. And it was sort of a different kind of thing where, she wasn't all bad. I mean, she, you know, had some redeeming qualities, the main character, and then she did this thing that was bad. And so, and I think everybody has that point where they have to make a decision. Are they going to take the high road or the low road? And most of us, I think, choose the high road, I think. And so, but my, you know, noir characters are faulty in that way, that they keep making the same mistakes. And so I really wish I knew. I mean, I think it has to do with noir. And I think it is my voice now for all of my stuff. And I don't know how that happened. I know for years I wanted to find a voice, my voice, and I found it through writing noir. And right. I don't only write noir. I mean, I have, you know, stories that are very decidedly not noir, but I don't know. You know, I look back at this story even, and I think, where did this even come from? Like, where was I? What did it come out of? And I think that with a lot of stories, I don't know where they came from.
Right.
They just kind of appeared. Does that happen with everyone else?
Can I just say about your story before? Yeah. It's a good question, but it's, you know, right. Your character maybe doesn't take the high road, but there is in a lot of noir, there's a kind of cynicism about human beings that I think in your story is really replaced by a wonderful generosity. Because, okay, Gunther is not a character that we are excited about, and not a good person. But I mean, the main character finds kindness in the world, and I think is herself kind and doing her best. So I thought there was something, in a way, I didn't think of it as noir because it wasn't ultimately dark in what it was saying about human nature, it seemed to me, which I really loved.
Yeah, yeah. It's light noir.
Yeah, deep, it's like sunshiny noir, Southern California noir, something. There's such, you know, even, and Elizabeth, she's not here right now, but she, one of the things she pointed out right away after the first time she read that story was how much she loved how you rendered those motel scenes, especially the ones out by the pool. My God, I mean, it, you know, and then you, I was looking at it on paper and it's like, you do it in so few words, but God, can you see that and feel that? And it made me want to get in the car, an old car, like a 63 Falcon, and drive to Arizona or Southern California and stay at one of those places.
Yeah, I love the desert, but yeah, it's true that I don't, it wouldn't fall into the category of, you know, the darkest noir, but it is interesting how it has shades of that. And also what you said, David, about the character. I mean, I think, you know, again, I think of noir characters as not just being these two-dimensional, you know, they're just all faulty, but they're you know, they want to be better and just keep devolving into this, making the same mistake over and over again. And I don't know, I can relate to that, I suppose, and fight against it. But yeah, it's interesting finding the voice, you know, finding the voice. That's kind of a hard thing for writers, isn't it? You know, really.
Yeah. And Mary, I have a question for you about voice. Now that you went through all those different voices and points of view for 5th of July, and you landed on the, you know, the winner, I was going to say killer, but the winner. and now it's time to write, you know, I assume you're writing other short stories or fiction, maybe a novel. I'm not sure what
short stories.
You're working on short stories. Yes. So now, do you lean toward third person just to start, or is it like every story starts from scratch in terms of voice?
I think I lean toward first person and then switch over to third. Really? That's just my style. But I knew right away that third was going to work for this. I wanted that distant perspective of looking at a woman just losing it.
Right.
Yes.
But you rough draft in first generally.
Generally, yes, I do.
Actually, when I was writing short stories a lot, that's what I would do as well. And I tended to leave them that way, but I would sometimes switch to third also.
Yeah, I've even written a story in the plural. It was fun. It wasn't published, but it was fun to do it. yes. And Barbara, you asked where we get our story ideas. I in the early on kind of picked from my own life and then fictionalized, but more and more I see a story or a photograph and I say, oh my God, I have to write about that. That I had a story published in Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, and I read a story about a woman in DC who was scammed on the phone. Someone called her and said, we have your daughter, we're holding her, and you need to go to all these wire transfer agencies and send us $10,000. And my thought was, who in the hell would fall for that? Who is so gullible? And it just took off from there.
Yeah.
So I get my
congrats on that pub, by the way, Mary. That's not an easy one to get.
Yeah, that's excellent.
This is not only in response to what you said, Mary, and encouragement to continue to do that, but to anyone listening who's thinking of submitting the coolest, please do what Mary did. Please do not write about yourself. I've written this as the reason. No, and I think this might be why I ticked a couple people off and they went off on me on social media. You know, we just get it's easily 50% of the manuscripts are about writers or professors. You know that. Or maybe graduate students even, you know, some are like, hell with it. I'm in an MFA program. I'm not even going to change it to a professor, or I'm not getting, you know, I'm a TA and I'm just going to call myself a professor and write about myself. And please don't do that. I mean, first of all, like we were saying, our audience for Coolest is we're hoping well beyond that. There's a lot of other people who do a lot of other things. You know, I think people who are college educated, especially well-educated as writers in the university, through the university system, forget about how privileged they are and how they are in a little world. And many of them complain about the ultra rich. And yes, there is Bezos and all those rich people, but I mean, we are people who've gotten MFAs and gotten, you know, master's degrees, et cetera. We are privileged. And I think there's, And then because the lit mags are all, there's kind of, let's all write about ourselves and publish stuff about ourselves. And really the rest of the world, the rest of the people who want to read stories out there are going, you know, we've had enough of this. So my point is, just like Mary, you heard that and then said, I'm getting way outside of myself to a person who I couldn't imagine myself being, because that strikes me as the most naive woman in the world. I mean, what a great premise though. Seriously, if anyone else can do that. And I'm even going to make a note to myself to do that kind of thing more. Please do that. And then please send us that story.
Yeah, Mark, talk about the future, because, you know, I was talking to a few people and they said, oh, this is going to happen again next year. And I said, it's meant to.
Yes. So annual anthology. It's right on the website, I think.
So the website is coolestamericanstories.com. And there on the website, you can read about the current issue, the current volume, and the future, and submitting. And so the deadline dates and all of that is on the website?
Yes, I believe the website, it might be in the submittable thing that you click. It might say October 15th, and on the website, we've changed it to September 15th. And the reason we've done that is really in order to get our blurbs, in order to get our arcs printed and out to, you know, with the lag time that, say, like the big media outlets need, we really have to have stories chosen by, you know, late summer at the latest. And so, you know, to suggest that it was like we were reading the entire year is a little bit of a misleading statement. Therefore, to tell people, well, you can submit all the way till October, you know, we weren't sure how it was going to go. We didn't know how many we would get. So that's why we first said January 15th through October 15th for the first year. But now we've officially changed it on the website from January 15th to September 15th.
Okay.
And who knows, maybe next year we'll even shorten that to August, depending on how many good ones we get and how many we get.
Sure. We're drawing to the end, and I wonder if anyone has any last words for the writers listening. Any advice that you've received that has stayed with you through the years, that has influenced your writing?
I think the thing that was most helpful to me is somebody early on telling me how important toughness is in this work, that it's not sort of tripping through the tulips, that, you know, a draft pours out of you and that's great and it's an accomplishment and it's almost for sure nowhere near done. And so just that bullheadedness of staying with it and revising it is so important. And then there's the part where you're trying to get it published. And I mean, you can get dozens of rejections on a story that's actually kind of good. So, you know, you need toughness at that end too. So, you know, if you've got two boxes in front of you and one says talent and the other says toughness, grab toughness.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. I completely echo that, particularly yep. being a I'm short here. Story writer that I use submittable, and I can't tell you how many rejections I get before I get an acceptance. It's you just can't even, you just have to let it roll right off your back. Another rejection, check it off the list and move on and submit to some more journals. So that I completely agree with that. And revision. I revise and revise and revise. I've never had a story hasn't been revised dozens and dozens of times. Mm-hmm. I agree.
What about you, Mark?
I think those are excellent pieces of advice. If I'm going to be teaching a 1-week short story writing class in Missouri, of all places, in about 6 weeks, I think. And I'm sure I will say these very things that David and Mary said. What I will add right now, so as not to be redundant, is a point of view of somebody who is kind of like an old guy and who's had all, you know, a bunch of stories published. I mean, some of the ways I got in some of these magazines is the fiction editor who didn't really like my style or my what I was about or me maybe personally died. And then another one came in and then I got in. So, but that's not the advice. Well, that is stay healthy. Stay healthy and hang in there. But I will also say this, it doesn't really get easier the you know, more experienced, more published or older you get. I remember thinking back when I was getting, you know, I was in my MFA program days and just after and really writing a lot of short stories and submitting. And the whole notion that we were taught and that every writer I knew at AWP or met here or there, we all thought, well, you just have to get a bunch of good credits and then you're going to get your book deal. That's how it works. Mm-hmm. And it's not, you know what? It's not how it works. It didn't work like that for me. I never got a book deal for the very best short stories of mine. Just never sure. happened. Mm-hmm. I had an agent, by the way, tell me after I reached 100 in just about every magazine I wanted to get in, literary magazine wise, and never gotten the New Yorker or the Atlantic. But a literary agent called me on the phone and said, you know, when you send this bio out, don't mention all these, literary magazines, because here at the Big Five Houses, literary magazines, that's for those people. And it's sort of this sentiment that we have at Coolest a little bit. You know, that, well, it's literary fiction, and it, and, you know, at best they sell 3,000 copies. And so money wise, the agents are thinking money, the Big Five Houses are thinking money, and that's just, it, they just write it off. So if they saw a guy in my case who had all these, you know, I went crazy with it. Everyone else was like, well, I'm going to get about 10 of them, get my one collection, then I'm going to get my deal for a novel. You know, I just kept going with the stories, and I kept thinking in the back of my mind, so that means when I do get my book deal, it's going to be for $10 zillion, right?
It just
doesn't work that way. And, you know, I'm grateful. At the time when that agent said it, I was devastated. I mean, really, but I'm kind of glad he told me that, because it has borne out to be pretty true, even from what I've observed with other writers who've kind of, you know, been at it for a while. So I guess the point, and I guess, you know, as I said, it doesn't really get any easier. Don't count on the fact that you have credits or you know what you're doing, you know, in quotes, to mean that the next story is going to be easy to write or easy to revise or easy to get published, because that's, you know, at least for me, that's not true.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally all good agree. Advice. And I would also add to that, to read widely and, you know, and to read literary publications that you want to be in, for instance, Coolest American Stories 2022.
That's definitely the one you want to read.
You know, because
at the top of the list, go to Amazon right now.
So often the problem is sending a good piece to the wrong place, right?
Yes.
That they're not going to take it no matter how good it is, because it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit with the style, the tone. So do your research and read. I want to thank all of you so much for spending this hour with me. And
thank you,
Mark. Thank you, Barbara, for the book, for coming up with the idea, you and Elizabeth, and
you're very welcome,
including me and Mary and David and the rest of the writers. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank all of you for submitting. I'm so glad that you did hear about us when you did, and that you sent us cool stories, which is what they ended up being, no doubt about it. And so thanks again for that.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That was Mark Wish, David Ebenbach, and Mary Tarr. This episode was produced by me, Barb DeMarco Barrett, on February 11th, 2022. Music and sound editing was by Travis Barrett. If you want to know more about the show, or you'd like to reach out to me or my co-host, Marie Stone, visit penonfire.com. Thanks for listening.